gives me great pleasure to introduce Michael Wood, who's going to talk to us about the true story of the Trojan Wars. And at the end, Michael will be available for signing books in the Waterstones tent, should you wish. So without further ado, you don't want to hear from me, we want to hear from Michael. So a big round of applause, please.
Thanks a lot, and welcome. It's great to be back at the dear old Chalk Valley History Festival. It's such fun, isn't it? And what changes we've seen since 2011, was it? On the cricket pitch at Bower Chalk, that first festival with three tents, and Jane, who's been here since the beginning, who's finally leaving us this year. We're going to really miss you, Jane, actually. Anyway, I hope you're having a great time. Let me find the... Yes! You'll note the confidence of the title, no question mark. I'll come back to that in a minute. I thought I'd bring the changes this year after several years of old English talks. I've gone back to an old interest of mine and a continuing interest of mine ever since I hitched around Greece and the Greek islands as a teenager. I'm going to talk about Troy. Older members of the audience may recall that some years ago now, actually nearly 40, I used to pretend it was a clerical error, but I can't get away with that anymore. Nearly 40 years ago, I did a series of films about the Trojan legend, and I wrote a book which unexpectedly saw the minutiae of the Greek Bronze Age top the bestsellers for several weeks. In the interim, though, really exciting new developments have taken place in this story. Troy has been re-excavated, partly in response to the films and the book, and there have been some very interesting new discoveries about the place names of Anatolia. Archaeology, linguistics, they're changing our view of the story. And it is, of course, one of the great stories in the world. Trojan War has been called the most famous war in the world. From Homer to Virgil to Shakespeare to our present day, there's no sign of interest in the story letting up. I mean, you will all know, of course, that it was Doctor who gave the Greeks the idea of building the wooden horse. And you will all remember that Helen's last lover was Captain James Kirk of the Starship Enterprise, who, as Troy burned in another galaxy, said, "I can't leave her, Bones. I can't leave her." And Bones' reply was, the immortal reply was, "It's no good, Jim. It's no good, Jim. You've got to get into the transporter. You can't change history. The Trojans are going to lose." And then, I'll get serious in a moment. And then, of course, Brad Pitt. What can I say about Brad Pitt? My kids loved it, but they were young and impressionable at the time. It was the moment when Helen and Paris faced each other as the walls of Troy came down and flames leapt into the sky, that the story of Troy was over. And Oliver Bloom turned to Helen of Troy and said, self-pitying, I felt, It's no good, Helen. I'm just not a hero." And Helen's unforgettable reply was, "It's not a hero I want, Paris. It's a man to grow old with." and you think, what in what crazed universe could a Hollywood scriptwriter come up with that when the truth of the matter, of course, is that what makes the Iliad so great is its cruel, remorseless, unforgiving ethic. hero begs for his life. And the man who's going to kill him says, "It was your destiny to die at my sword, so face your death like a man." A brief account of the story for those who don't know it. Sometime in the Bronze Age, the Greeks had a sense of the Bronze Age. Let's say around 1300 BC, because it was late in the Bronze Age, not long before the Greek world collapsed and the palaces were destroyed. A Trojan embassy to Sparta ended up abducting the queen of Sparta, the most beautiful woman in the world, Helen. An embassy headed by Paris or Alexandros. He has two names. I'll come back to that. The Prince of Troy. And they sail back to Troy, and the Greeks are then demand her restitution, and the Trojans, for some insane reason, refuse. And the Greeks mount an expedition. The high king of the Greeks, Agamemnon, calls his vassals together and his subordinate kings. They raise 1,000 ships and they sail to Troy to win Helen back and to punish the Trojans. That's the legend. That's the legend. But these are always worth thinking about. And of course, there's a 10-year war. The war ends in devastation. The wooden horse. Where does that story come from? The Greeks gain entrance to the city by the wooden horse, in which are concealed Greek warriors who will open the gates and send the signal and bring the Greeks in. The city is destroyed. The women are all raped or enslaved. The male children and all the males are killed. That's the nature of warfare in the ancient world, and that's what Homer's story is really about. Women as the victims of war. I thought of the Iliad recently when Mariupol in the Ukraine was destroyed in the way that it was. And the story first appears in Homer, composed orally, probably, the poem, the Iliad, in about 700 BC or a little later. But it was obviously already very well known. I shot this picture in the museum in Mykonos, and it's a Greek vase, and you can see on it, and it's from not long after 700 BC. Can you see the... I think I've got one of these. If it works. Maybe it doesn't. But you can see the Greek warriors... staring out of their little windows. It was already well known. The wooden horse story doesn't have any part in Homer's Iliad. So the story was already probably ancient, and we'll see that there's plenty of evidence, even within Homer's text, that the story was ancient. And ever after, of course, the tale spread. The Greeks themselves believed that it was a true story. The first great battle between East and West, Thucydides, the great historian Thucydides, thought. Alexander the Great went and paid his homage by the Dardanelles at the temple where they thought these things had happened. Many later conquerors. Nobody had lost sight of where Troy was at that stage. The search for Troy will come later. That, in a nutshell, is where Troy was. And you'll see it's on a borderline between Europe and Asia. The way the Greeks interpreted it, the way Thucydides saw it, Alexander the Great, even Mehmed II, the Turkish... ruler who conquered Constantinople, all of them saw it as a clash between East and West. And as I'm going to show you today, there is an element of truth in the real war, which we now know took place at that time. So where was Troy? The memory of where Troy had been precisely, although the general location was never forgotten, was forgotten. After the end of the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire of the East, and in the 18th century, many travellers came to the Troad, the land of Troy, to try to figure out where exactly these great events had taken place. They interpreted it literally. You know, was this where Achilles had driven his chariot, dragging the body of Hector round the walls of Troy? Where was it possible for that to take place? And these I hope you can see them at the back, these wonderful hand-tinted paintings come from, they were done by a camera obscura by William Gell in about 1804. And that's the view down from the mountains looking over the plain of Troy. The great Bechica Bay, the island of Tenedos out to the left, the island of Imbros, and just peeping above Imbros, the dark peak of the island of Samothrace, where Homer says Poseidon watched the battle from a distance. And in particular, that view, later legend, of course, said that the Greeks had used Tenedos, that little island offshore, as their base during the war. And when the warriors had hidden inside the wooden horse and broke out in the middle of the night and sent the signal, then the ships came across from Tenedos to land the troops and begin the attack. These are just stories, of course, but in the 1830s and 40s, people began to map the land, the landscape of the Triad a bit more carefully, it soon became clear that the site of the ancient city from classical times, from the Roman period, 1,000 years or more after the supposed events of the Trojan War, had been on a little hill. Let me just see if I can make this work. That's not working. Anyway, you can see just there, that's the site of the classical city of Troy. And that hill there, underneath the words large building with Hissalik round it, that's where people started to think about the site of Troy itself. In the engravings of the time, starting in the 18th century, you can sometimes pick it up. That big mound on the left is the site of the Acropolis of New Ilium, built by the Greeks and the Romans 1,000 or more years afterwards. It's always struck me, that picture, as a kind of hill of mysteries, that within that hill, all the secrets of this story were probably contained. There may even have been archives of clay tablets that were destroyed subsequently by the archaeologists. But at that moment, before it was touched, it was still there. Charles McLaren, who was the editor of The Scotsman, was the first person to identify this precisely with the site of the Citadel of Troy in 1822. That's his little sketch, a rude outline. And it was McLaren's book which led Schliemann, Heinrich Schliemann, to the site in 1869. He's the fourth from the left at the top, self-made millionaire, obsessed by the story of Troy from youth, so he said, but actually probably given the clues by this guy here, Frank Calvert, who was the British consul in the Dardanelles and who'd actually done a bit of excavation at Troy. And he encouraged Schliemann to begin the dig, and Schliemann did this on a massive scale. I've copied these photographs from the German Institute in Athens from glass plates, and they give you a sense of what they saw in the 1870s. The first thing that strikes me about this photo is the height of it. Homer talks about Ilios, Troy, being high, steep, windy. And you can see from this picture here, it's about 100 feet above the river plain. And there's Schliemann's workmen, there were 150 of them any one time, smashing their way through classical walls because they believed that the Troy they were looking for would be deep inside the mound. So sadly, a huge amount of it just went. This is the great trench that Schliemann dug right through the middle of the mound, the Trojan plain beyond. Deep down in the mound, and of course it had been inhabited for thousands of years, they found a ramp and a tiny citadel. But actually it was hundreds and hundreds, thousands of years before any possible Troy. And that's what it looked like after the seasons from 1871 to 1873. They had literally smashed away the top of the hill. The sides of the hill facing us are actually just the spoil tips of the debris that they'd poured down the side of the hill. And in so doing, they destroyed a huge amount of the evidence. So that's what it's like after 20 years of, nearly 20 years of Schliemann's returns to the site and so on. You can see up there just the contour of part of the original hill, yeah? And in the middle where somebody's standing on it. That's the extent to which they devastated the hill. So right at the end of Schliemann's life, and that's him there, faint photo, but I find it particularly touching, his disciple, Wilhelm Derpfeld, with his hand on his shoulder, Frank Calvert still there, the old British consul. Right at the end of his life, they realized what a terrible mistake they'd made. And you could still see in the photographs some of the evidence for the Troy that they had destroyed. Can you see this here? With these very distinctive offsets, sloping back and offsets. That's a big house from the period of the Troy, of the Trojan War, which Schliemann had just blitzed through to get to the middle of the mound. And after his death, Derpfeld pulled out and on one side discovered that the walls were still surviving under the ground. And here's some of the shots from the German Archaeological Institute of what Derpfeld found. That's Derpfeld himself leaning nonchalantly on a bit of stone with his natty German boss archaeologist outfit. You can see the city walls here again with these very distinctive offsets. Derpfeld noted that Homer mentioned that there was a slope to the walls of Troy, and in places it was possible that you could ascend the walls by getting your feet in the cracks. And indeed, he describes Achilles in his fury racing up one of these sloping walls and engaging the warriors on the top. But there's the city walls of the real Troy from the period of the Late Bronze Age, and some of the structures, very impressive. There would have been mud brick towers surmounting these things. So Derpfeld was convinced that Schliemann was dead, but our master Schliemann could never have believed in his wildest dreams that we could have actually discovered the historical Troy, Derpfeld wrote. You see here the classical walls from later Troy and the Bronze Age walls inside. And Schliemann had just on one whole side of the town just removed them. I don't know whether you can see this clearly at the back, but this is Derpfeld's picture of what there would have been in the classical period. The remains that were left behind, the destroyed town walls, and the Temple of Athena on top from the Roman period, and indeed the Temple of Athena where Alexander the Great had left his sword and shield as an offering to the goddess Athene. And Derpfeld, here's his map. You can see how complicated the site was. It was, you know, nobody's supposing Schliemann in a new science could have ever mastered all this, but they just didn't take care. And the red bit is the Troy of the period of the Trojan War, and you can see it's all gone from the northern side. And Derpfeld was so convinced by his discoveries, and we're in the 1890s now, that he even drew this map, which is to show the citadel of Troy as it's portrayed in Homer, if you like. The Scaean gate at the top, the Dardanian gate at the bottom, even the hill with the olive tree where the Trojan women had looked out to identify the Greek heroes. And this was adopted by all Homerists, pretty much all, in the years leading up to the First World War. Walter Leaf, the most famous British guy. That was the historic Troy had been found. And Dirtfeld even drew a map of how the war might have taken place. There's the rivers, Troy, the road, the Greek camp by the Dardanelles. Anybody who's been there would know that it's a complete impossibility because the current of the Dardanelles is so strong. But we'll come back to that. And other features. Almost everything in this map, it now turns out, is wrong. But for 80 years, it was kind of believed. In between his digs at Troy, Schliemann excavated a number of famous mainland sites, also connected with the legend. He was driven by the legend in the belief that in Homer's story, although it's hundreds of years later than the war, there was a historical truth. And he went to Mycenae first of all, as the city of King Agamemnon, the leader of the Greeks. And Mycenae in the classical period was a tiny place, a forgotten place. But the Homeric tradition was that this was the center of the over-king of the Greeks. There it is on its hill, massively fortified. It's one of the characteristics of that period. All these palaces and cities are massively fortified. War must have been the very currency of life. Palace on the top, Cyclopean walls as they're known. And Schliemann, although he made so many mistakes, had a kind of incredible luck as an archaeologist. He struck gold even when he didn't know what he was finding. And he struck it at Mycenae too. The great tombs of the Greek kings from that period. This is 13th century BC. The shaft graves, which are long before the period of the Trojan War, but each one of the semi-mummified bodies covered with gold masks and extraordinary treasures. I'd love to show you lots of those today, but we're going to stick to the story of Troy. It was a palace civilization. Throne rooms of this kind at Mycenae, Pylos, Tiryns. It was a civilization where warfare was endemic, where the chariot was the key means of transport to the battlefield by the elites. Homer still knows something about the weaponry of that period. Indeed, he even harks back to weaponry from before the Trojan War, like these long shields. Can you see? There's a description of Ajax running towards the Trojan War with his long rectangular shield banging the back of his legs as he runs. It's that kind of shield. And several of the things that Homer describes have been dug up. So even though it's hundreds of years later, these metrical formulas describing the weapons, for example, the phasganon argeruilon, the silver-studded sword, they've been found in excavation. So fossils from a much older period had come down in the text of Homer, even though he'd no longer seen anything like that in his day, in particular something like this, the boar's tusk helmets, which Homer describes, but were long gone by Homer's day. So they've come down in the text, which has been handed down over centuries of oral tradition. And the other thing I would add about these, I've said it already, this is Tiryns. They're massively, massively fortified. Even only a few miles apart, Tiryns, Argos, Medea. That's the world of the Mycenaean kings. So what was the world of Anatolia? today's Turkey. Because after all, this is a war in which the Greeks invade Anatolia. Well, they came late on the scene in terms of archaeology, and it was a very grim, windy, and bleak couple of days that I spent here at Hattusha, so my slides are not great, but in the mountainous world of central Turkey, huge fortifications, this is what it looked like. Nothing was known of the Hittite Empire until late 19th century, early 20th. Giant fortifications. And only fragmentary images. We know very little about them in some ways. The kings were kind of priest kings. But that's their empire at the time of Mycenae and the Trojan War. So the question we're going to ask ourselves now is, did those worlds come into contact? And indeed they did. The key find when the Hittite capital was excavated from 1906 onwards were diplomatic tablets, prayers, treaties, massive literature, the first recorded Indo-European literature. And it was deciphered 1915, 1917 by Hrozny, and immediately astounding discoveries were made. All the things that we don't have for the Greeks, we have for the Hittites, even if we can't picture them. The texts were astonishing. And among them were diplomatic letters, archives, and treaties concerning the wars and the relations between the Hittites and their western and southern allies and enemies during the 13th century BC. This is a time when the Hittite Empire was really big. They fought huge battle with the Egyptian Empire under Ramses II in Kadesh in 1274. So they were a big power. They could put 35,000 men into the field against the Egyptians. But the most astounding discoveries concerned the Greeks. And the discoveries were first flagged by this guy, Emil Forer, who was a young scholar in 1920. But I had the uncanny experience of actually talking to him, age 90, when we were making our films. He was then living, of all places, in El Salvador. But Forer was the guy who first proposed these amazing parallels between the Hittite texts and the Greek tradition. The Greek names for Troy, and there were two names for Troy, Ilios and Troia. But Ilios has lost its W, its digamma from ancient Greek. Originally it would have been pronounced Wilios. And the Greek and the Hittite city in the northwest was Wiliusa. And an alternative name or a name close by, Taruia. And the Hittite name for a powerful kingdom out to the west, Achaea, or Achaea. And the king of Wiliusa was Alexandros, as Homer calls Paris, Alexandros. Again, he has two names, one Greek and one possibly Anatolian. The Hittites, the Trojans, worshipped a god, Apollon, who must be the same, Apollonas, who must be the same god as the Greeks later called Apollo. He's the patron god of the Trojans. And I've added these two at the bottom because they both look like Anatolian names, Paria, Paris, and Pariamu, Priam. Taken together, these parallels suggested that actually the Greeks were well known to the Hittites as a powerful kingdom. And indeed, Forer pointed out there were tablets like this one, a treaty addressed to the kings who are my equals in rank, the kings of Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, and the king of Achaea. That's crossed out. But it's there. More than that, there seemed to be warfare between the Greeks and the Hittites. Tell the great king of Achaiawa, say to his majesty, the king of Hatti, my brother, hostilities have broken out. Indeed, the matter of Wilusa, about which we were at war, we were hostile, all this seemed to be there in the tablets back in the 1920s when Emil Forer published this. But he was crushed by the German academic establishment, who thought such suggestions were just flighty and ridiculous. So by the time we get into the 1930s, the geography of Western Anatolia is still unclear. Where was Achaiawa? Where were the other nations mentioned in these tablets? But the basic picture of the Hittite Empire had developed, ruling down into Syria and to Kadesh, where they fought their great battle with Ramses II. Meantime, Troy is re-excavated by the Americans. They found more features of the citadel of Troy, a great tower by the gate, houses with central pillars that obviously were arranged in a terrace around the hill, with central columns holding up a second floor. There were plinths for statues by the gate, probably statues of the Trojan gods. There were even, and this is a photo from the excavation, there were even signs that the city had undergone a siege. Storage jars dug in the floors everywhere on the lower terraces. And indeed, the Americans were able to decipher two destructions of the citadel of Troy during the period which we're interested in, from 1300 to 1200, 1150. One soon after 1300, and one, well, we now know, probably around 1170. So, interesting, but all this changed with the decipherment of the script found on the tablets in the Greek palaces in Mycenae and Knossos, the decipherment of the Linear B script in the 1950s. Nobody had ever dreamt that it would be Greek. It was assumed Greek speakers had come into what's now Greece after the Bronze Age, but here they were. Here in these Greek texts, you can see Atana Potnia, Lady Athena, yeah? Artemeto, Artemis, Poseidao, Poseidon, the god of the sea, Enuario, Enualius, the pretty much forgotten now god of war. Details of military dispositions. Each big palace like Pylos could put 100 ships into an expedition. Some of the words, if you're Greek speakers, you'll still recognize today, Erita, rowers. And even more, information about the seizure of women. Not just from one place, systematically seized all over the shores of the Eastern Aegean as plunder in war. Knidos on the southern Turkey, Zephyros, which is Halicarnassos, Bodrum today, Miletus, Chios, Lemnos, Asiweia, which is the word that we now use for Asia, Asua, which is just the area opposite Chios, that's where the name originally comes from, and even Tauroja, possibly Troy. So here was evidence of palaces that were massively fortified, tooled up with immense military arsenals, capable of organizing fleets of 50, 60, 70, even 100 ships, and engaged in aggressive interference on the shores of Asia. Putting all this together, it was inevitable Troy would be excavated for a fourth time. And that came after the films that we made. Manfred Kaufman, the excavator, wrote me a letter saying he'd been intrigued by especially the book that I'd written, which was translated into German. And it was one of the reasons that they'd applied for big grants from the humanities in Germany to begin a re-excavation of Troy. And that's what they found. There's the citadel at the top, and as Dirtfeld had guessed, there was a big lower city. Can you make that out at the back? I hope you can, yeah. The outer walls defended by with anti-chariot ditches, quite wide ditches, palisades, and so on. The citadel, they tidied up probably what we could finally guess after Schliemann's depredations had been there in the north. And this is what Troy looked like. In the heyday that we're talking about. A citadel for the royal family and a lower town. Maybe 6,000 people, something like that. Could have been as many as 10, we don't know. But ruling a much wider territory. That's the historical Troy, as far as archaeology can let us know. Am I all right for time, by the way? Are we? Where's the? There's the bastion, as it would have been with a mud brick on top. But the most interesting discovery from the new excavations was that there was no plain of Troy in 1300 BC. As with the other rivers in Anatolia, it was a huge bay that silted up over the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. So there can't have been a Greek camp on the Dardanelles. And this brought attention to this bay here, which for thousands of years probably had been the place used by shipping, waiting for the winds to change to go into the Dardanelles. It's even where the British fleets anchored during the Crimean War, and a mini town grew up. That's the key. There's Troy on its bay. Temple on the top, probably. That's all cut away by the Romans when they built their own city. So was there a war? Well, that great wide bay is the bay I just pointed out to you, Beshika Bay. And Homer's description of the war is that the Greek fleet anchored between two prominent headlands. The fleet was drawn up on the long shore, and that was the Greek base for the period of the war. And this is what happened. This is not supposition. This we know is what happened. We begin with the Hittite Emperor Mursilis in 1319 and 1318 BC. The date is secure because of a solar eclipse. Who goes down to the Aegean coast, conquers the Greek territory of Miletus, attacks the people of that coast. There's Mount Mycale. Mursilis describes in great detail in one of the great battle narratives of the ancient world what it was like in that campaign, what he and his generals were doing. And I myself, my majesty, went to Mount Arinanda. This place is very inaccessible. It stretches out into the sea, and moreover, it's very high and thickly wooded. It's not suitable for the ascent of chariotry. All of the civilians who'd fled from us occupied it, and the enemy infantry were up there. And because the ground was unsuitable for the ascent of chariots, I went on foot before the army, and I went up. He goes and describes the capture of thousands of captives from that side of the Anatolian shore. And so for the first time in history, an Asian power looked out to the Greek islands. And added to this, the discoveries of the last 20 years allow us to be secure about the boundaries of the countries which he'd subdued. He'd campaigned down here to the country of Arzawa, whose capital was Apasa, Ephesus, and those are the other countries around. And Wilusa, we can now say securely, was Troy. When Mursilis died, his son Muatali succeeded him in 1295. Now we come to the point of the war. And this is just to remind us that Greek sources remembered who Muatali was. Indeed, they even had a tradition that he had sheltered Paris and Helen at the time of the Trojan War. But as soon as Mursilis died, the old royal family of that side of Anatolia landed with a Greek army and tried to regain their kingdoms on that shore. And their war of conquest led them up to Troy itself. And they captured the island of Lesbos, Lazpa, according to the Hittites. There's the land of Troy, just over the strait on the other side. The Hittite letters talk about 7,000 prisoners having been taken at this point. And then comes the correspondence of letters between the two kings. This is probably the first piece of Indo-European literature that we've got. The Greek king writes to the Hittite emperor, "In the previous year, my brother, you wrote to me as follows." This is what the Hittite king said. "I didn't take from you any of your islands which you call your inheritance from the king of Assur. The storm god gave them to me as subjects." "Now," says the Greek king, "the king of Assur, which is that part of Anatolia, was on good terms with the king of the Greeks, the Achaeans. So his great-grandfather, Kagamuna, previously married the daughter of the Greek king. And then Tudhalia, your great-grandfather," he's talking to the Hittite king, "defeated the king of Assur and subjugated him. But the islands indeed formerly belonged to us." So there's a territorial dispute about these islands off the shores of Anatolia. Muatali sends an army to intervene. On the way, it meets a subordinate king who sends a letter back to the king of the Hittites. "At the moment, everything's calm. General Gassu has arrived with the Hittite army. When they attacked Troy, I was ill." He goes on quite a long way about his being ill. He's probably trying to make an excuse for his inaction. "They humbled me, and then they went on to attack Lesbos." So that's the campaign of the Hittite army under General Gassu that finally leads them to Troy itself. And that's the moment we can imagine the Greek forces and the Hittite forces and the Arzawans coming into conflict. Greek troops like this, with their metalled helmets, greaves, wearing greaves on their legs, and so on. There's even a Hittite representation of a Greek warrior. They'd obviously come into conflict. It's with a long horsetail decoration to the helmet. There's a great moment in Homer where Hector dandles his little boy, Astyanax, and the kid bursts out crying, frightened by the swish of the great long horsetail on his helmet, which Hector has forgotten to take off. So that's the moment of the clash between the Hittites and the Greeks. We may be able to discover a lot more about that when a new site is excavated soon, which was Muatali's capital, which has not been excavated so far. There may be an untouched archive there. In the year or two later, Muatali sends another expedition down to hit the Greeks down at Miletus and to pacify the whole story. And what trace has come down to us on the ground, and what trace has come down in Homer to these events? Well, we go back to that map and the Beshika Bay here, which we now have to assume was where the Greeks had camped. There it is. You see the mound on the left-hand side, traditionally the mound of Achilles. In the ancient world, they pointed that out as the tomb of the hero Achilles. When it was excavated by the Germans 20 years ago, they discovered a cemetery had been, for a very brief time, had been dug into the side of that hill and around it. Mainly probably cenotaphs of dead Greek aristocrats. But right from that moment of around 1295. So let's look at what Homer says about the actual course of the battle. If that is the bay where the Greeks camped then and built their defences, a strange feature of Homer's text is he talks about the stoma limne, the pool by the shore, protecting most of the Greek camp. And sure enough, when they did soil cores, they discovered, can you see the green there? In the time of the Trojan War, there'd been a lagoon, and not in Homer's time. So he was, again, handed down to him was the tradition of that there'd been this feature of the landscape. And then another feature of the landscape was the rising of the plain, the throsmos. Nobody was sure what that meant because there was no such feature in the plain, but there is just here. When the Trojans attacked the Greeks in that camp, that's what they would have seen. This is what it would have looked like. The Trojans made their attack on the Greek camp down from the rising of the plain and broke into the Greek camp, burning one of the ships, even though it was protected by the pool. The next feature, after the stoma limne and the throsmos, is the bridges of war. Homer's got this wonderful description of the armies at night with the starry sky, the myriad stars, and as the armies camped on the bridges of war. And again, it's an ancient phrase in Homer, which is much older than his time, which is describing the causeways that they built across the river in order to get to the Trojans. There's the river. And that enables us, finally, to give a sense of how we would redraw Derpfeldt's map of Troy itself. The blue are what we now know of the outer walls of the city. And instead of a Scaean gate being up there, the two gates, Scaean means the left-hand gate and the Dardanian gate, and the great Tower of Ilion, where the Trojan women looked out to identify the Greek heroes. We may be going too far in imagining, but it sounds as if Homer's account has preserved some memories of an actual war. And that's how I would interpret these events, very precisely on this reading. 1295, accession of Muwatalli. The prince of the Arzawans, with Greek help, invades Anatolia. They attack Wilusa, which is Troy. They attack Lesbos and take their thousands of prisoners. The Hittites under Gassu then defeat them, and Wilusa, Troy, is recaptured. And finally, Muwatalli makes his treaty with the king of Wilusa, who's been reinstated. So Paris Alexander, she's not killed in the real war, unlike the Homer story. He is reinstated as king of Troy. And finally, how did it get down to Homer? Well, that's another very long story. This is a picture of a bard and a lyre from Pylos. There's no doubt that there was an oral tradition of singing songs and singing of great events back in the Bronze Age, but it seems to have taken centuries for the tradition to coalesce around the particular story Homer tells. And of course, the story he tells is only like over two or three months in the ninth year of the war. Many other great events in the war are not dealt with in Homer. So it's just one story. And maybe Homer was particularly praised and his work was preserved simply because he was deemed to be the best. But it was probably not till about 600 BC that the text was written down. And the text that we have, it's still that text had changes in it before the version that we've got from about the year 1000 AD. So 1500 years after it was written down, and more than 2500 years after the war, that's the text that is the key to our knowledge of Homer today. So that gives you a sense of how the war might have taken place. As I said, we've got a new Hittite capital, has been identified in 2019. If the archive there is untouched, then maybe the answer to some of these questions will become apparent. But all of these things, there are gaps, there are suppositions, but the essential facts of this story now are starting to emerge as a real narrative for the first time. Thanks a lot. Anybody got any? Have we got time for a question or two? Yes, yeah, the wooden horse. It's a really interesting story, isn't it? Is it just a myth or... you know, is it possibly, as in my opening slide from the Trojan War video game, is it actually a wooden siege machine in which men hid and advanced it on wheels up to the walls with a tower maybe that people went up on ladders to get onto the battlements, or even with a battering ram like the Assyrian siege engine? So I think nobody knows yet, but that's a plausible explanation, isn't it? You know, a siege engine.
I was interested in your concept of East and West, or your mentioning of the concept of East and West. What was their understanding of East and West at that time? I've never come across it before. Did they have a divide? What did they know about?
That's not them. That's me making that divide. But and of course, these are very big questions to answer about views of East and West, and we mustn't interpret them in today's terms. But when I mentioned Thucydides, you know, Thucydides is writing in 5th, 4th century BC, his history of the war between Athens and Sparta, but he begins by mentioning the Trojan War back in time, and he saw it as the first of these battles between peoples to the east and peoples of Greece and Europe. You know, the Persians had invaded Greece in the 5th century, for example. They were deemed to be Easterners. Alexander the Great invaded Persia in the 4th century. So I think my reading of it would be that the Aegean Sea marks quite a divide. And certainly in Greek geography, Europa starts with the Aegean Sea. So it's a shorthand, really, but I think there is some... And it's the way they understood these conflicts through history. But, of course, there's a lot to... the concept of the West is something that needs to be unpicked. Actually, if you're really interested, there's a new book about the idea of the West is just out, which is very interesting. I've written a column about the idea of the West in the new BBC History magazine, but that's not the same as this. I think that's the sense that beyond the Aegean Sea in Anatolia, there were was a different world. Although the Hittites spoke an Indo-European language, and the Trojans spoke an Indo-European language, probably Luwian, but people saw these things in later times as being epoch-making conflicts. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your brilliant talk. I love the way you married the sense of place with an excitement about the literature of the time, which brings it all to life.
Thank you.
Given that the scene has shifted from what we thought was the point of the war to a different place, at least the Greek landing in the camp and the bridges of war perhaps in a slightly different place. is there or might there be a place for revisiting the archaeological point of the wall and actually looking for clues as to what might have been there, which might have been left uncovered, given it wasn't over researched.
This is about the archaeology of war, and archaeology of war is a difficult question, even in comparatively recent battles. I think, for instance, Hastings, there's never been any battle relics discovered from the battlefield of Hastings, so you don't really expect that you'll come up in the First World War, of course, but you're dealing with gigantic armies and in very limited areas. But whether you'd find any, I think, first of all, inside the citadel of Troy, battle remains have been found for both the destruction soon after 1300, and I should have mentioned that the pottery dating for the destruction of that fine city of Troy is very spot on around the 1290s, which we're speculating on the grounds of it being Mu'attali. So they've found the remains in the streets and stuff like that that were covered over and built over, but from that period. And similarly, the destruction of Troy in the 1170s BC, there's a lot of evidence for even dead in the streets in some of those places. Whether you'd have any chance of discovering remains of a Greek camp, it's a huge bay, Beshika Bay, and you'd be, it's probably looking for a needle in a haystack with the sea running over that shore for the last 3,000 years. You're probably very unlikely to find anything, I think it would be. And siege causeways, I mean, the two rivers that come down past Troy, one of them is particularly powerful in the winter. It's a big river, and the evidence is probably washed away long, long ago. So I think it's the site of Troy itself gives you the evidence of the fighting.
Is there any evidence to prove that the Helen story was true?
Yeah, Helen of Troy. Yes, I think I ended the last word in our TV series was in archaeology, the history of love leaves no trace, or something like that. The funny thing is, the Greek, epic tradition in Ireland, in India, for example, the Ramayana, epic tradition will often make the seizure of a woman in these ancient cultures can be the pretext for war. I mean, as I've shown you, the seizure of real women, probably in their thousands, to work on textile, in the textile industry and so on, is the reality of war in that time. And Homer's text is very, if you get away with the Oxford classicist's vision of what Homer is, it's a very, very brutal story in which women are hugely the victims of war. And violence against women is the norm in those kind of wars, as it has been through history. Interestingly enough, those Linear B tablets that speak of women from all those places like Miletus and Halicarnassos and so on being shipped back to Greece to work on textile, flax plantations and textile works and stuff like that. They're slaves from that time. They've been abducted. The 7,000 prisoners on Lesbos are textile people. So, actually, the Pylos tablets from the Bronze Age Palace of Pylos in the 13th century do signify some of these groups out there in the subordinate villages to Pylos. And there's one of those places today where the river is still called Linaria, which means flax river. So you can still just catch that deep prehistory. And there's a village near, in the back of the hills near Mycenae, called Tenea, where the Pausanias, the great travel writer in the Roman period, says that the villagers still claim they were descended from Trojan prisoners who had been shipped out there and settled there and never got home. You know, so I think that history of slavery, of violence against women, is a big part of that Bronze Age warfare, as it is of warfare throughout history.